This podcast is part of the Gunna Geek Network. The opinion expressed may not represent other podcasts or affiliates of Gunna Geek. Check out more podcasts at GunnaGeek.com and get ready because geekiness starts in 3, 2, 1.
Critics say we should be watching these movies.
But we're here to see if they're right.
Join us as we take a cinematic journey through independent and classic film.
So dim the lights.
And get ready for the show.
This is Art House Legends Podcast, where high art and geek culture collide. Welcome to the podcast that definitely looks blue in the moonlight. This is the Movie Dude Eric, and along with me are...
This is Kent, and I have nothing witty this week. Sorry.
And I think we have ourselves a couple of special guests with us.
Yes, back from the dark side of the moonlight. Lobster is in the trap.
Yeah. Oh, and a special guest, Caesar. Hey.
Hey, Caesar. Hey. All right, and so we're talking about the second Best Picture winner of the Academy Awards 2017, right?
That's right. Yep. The definitive, yeah. The one that wasn't 15 seconds, the winner. And that is Moonlight, starring Alex R. Hibbert, Ashton Sanders, Trevante Rhodes, Jaden Piner, Andre Holland, Naomi Harris, Janelle Monáe, and Lobster, will you give us our special guest of this episode?
Mahershala Ali, one of my favorite actors from Luke Cage, 4400, House of Cards. I love this guy.
Oh, we're going to be talking. And directed by Barry Jenkins. So, yes, this is the definitive Best Picture winner. The one that was supposed to be, if it weren't for those pesky people at, what was the?
PricewaterhouseCoopers.
PricewaterhouseCoopers.
Yeah. Coopers, those mother freaking accountants.
Tweeting accountants.
Yeah, they weren't tweeting. That's why.
Yeah. Man. It's all Twitter's fault.
I feel that this is very familiar because, oh yeah, that's right. We did this episode before, except that audio just completely crashed on us, and now we're having to do this again.
It's like the Moonlight Curse.
You did the audio, but what's his name came in and personally ruined it. Wait, shit.
See, this is why we don't get PricewaterhouseCoopers to do our audio. Okay.
Yeah.
No. It was Faye Dunaway and Warren Beatty. They came in and fucked with it. Beatty didn't have his glasses on. He didn't click save, and that just ruined it.
Too close to truth. Too close to truth. No, I'm kidding. All right, but yeah. So, out of curiosity, though, how did you see this film? Did you see this before the Academy Award? Before it became the Best Picture winner? Did you see it afterwards? And Lobster, why don't you start us off?
I watched it today for the first time because it just hit. Amazon Prime Instance Video, and this had been like I had wanted to see it, but it kept popping up and disappearing at local cinemas, and evidently they didn't do a lot of advertising for this film, and by a lot I mean they didn't do any advertising for this film. It just was a word of mouth sort of thing. It's actually the second lowest grossing movie to ever win Best Picture. Which I think is kind of cool. Like, it just is this little movie that could. And I had really, really wanted to see it. And obviously, when it won the Best Picture, I was happy for it, even though I hadn't seen it. I kind of had the sense that it would be something I would enjoy watching. But I got the invitation to return to my old stomping grounds of Art House Legends. You gave me the excuse to sit down and watch it, which I finally got to today, and loved it. Oh, spoiler! Sorry. You guys have already talked about this film, and I'm not going to ask whether you passed, failed, or maybe that on the first go round. I want to know: is anyone changing their vote? Did you sit down and watch it again, or are you going? Are you just going through the motions?
My vote stays the same.
I'm not going to go there because I actually want to build up to that. But I did actually see this again for a fourth time. for this episode,
okay.
Which will be the second time for this podcast, or I guess the third time.
I commiserate with audio issues. We've had our fair share over on Legends Podcast, where I'm currently based.
Cheap plug.
We did an episode of the podcast where it was just me and Nightwing, John, and we talked about the film Bon Cop, Bad Cop, which is the Anglophone, Francophone, Canadian buddy comedy. And we thought it would be funny because it was just the two of us. And obviously, Wing is French-Canadian. And then he ended up recording the entire episode on his webcam mic and not his good-sounding mic.
I've done that before.
And so we were bummed that the audio quality was shit. But no one understands him anyway, so it's fine.
There you go. All right, so Caesar, did you see this before the Academy Awards?
No, I saw it after. Well, basically, that's it. Like, literally, like, after it won, I waited on Tuesday when it was released in Best Buy, and I just took a chance and bought the movie.
Well, I think I mentioned to you that this is something that you could just go ahead and do a blind buy for after I saw it, right? If I'm not correct, that's what I said after...
In other words, this is not a movie that you're going to regret owning or regret having in your collection.
Yeah, no, not at all.
I guess one person's already told you their opinion. We'll get to the later.
You told him it was a blind buy, meaning a blind buy is something that you can buy sight unseen and feel okay about.
I know Caesar. We've been friends for a very long time. So as soon as I saw the film, I knew
Caesar will like this.
Yeah.
Okay. How about Kent? Kent, did you sit down and watch it again? Are you?
I didn't have time again to watch it this weekend. First time I watched it was
the first time you saw it was the first time you podcasted about it.
Yeah, okay. And it had been on sale that week, and I was like, "Oh yeah, I got to get this now." It was a very good price for the DVD. Grab it.
Okay.
There you go.
And the family chiming in behind you about it too, or?
Yes, they are chiming in about
okay,
it.
Okay, good.
So they want to bring their opinions on this. We can make this a family effort.
Yeah.
Family episode.
Good, it's all good.
But okay, so I guess I'm the only one who saw it before the Academy Awards. I actually saw this when it just came out of theaters. Just happened to be playing at a theater near me, and it was one of those movies that I'd never heard of anything about this, and I went in completely blind, knew nothing. All I knew was that the critics were raving about it. And so I went in, and I thought that the movie was going to go in one direction, and it kind of went in a different direction. And after the movie, I was really conflicted over what I thought about it.
Sure.
Now, I should say that for anyone who's been onto the vidcast, they know that this made my top 20 films of the year.
Okay.
So whether or not I keep that opinion, we're going to get into that. But I will say, though, that it did leave a deep impression on me that I've actually had to do two videos on Moonlight. So we'll be getting into that.
It was more romantic than I thought it would be. I'll put it that way. Like, it went in more of a heartfelt direction. Like, I knew it was a heartfelt movie because movies that win Best Picture tend to be heartfelt movies. Like, you can say pretty much that there's a positive message somewhere in the film, right? Like it ends on an up note, I guess. It's just one of those things that you say, okay, one Best Picture, here's what I can probably expect, right?
I yes and no. I think there have been films that the Academy has kind of appreciate that weren't love-based, but they do kind of prefer a love story for the most part.
Right, and I'm not saying even a love story, like Schindler's List, right? Like, Schindler's List isn't what you would call a romance. It's not I don't know. But there's heart to it.
You're talking more like poetic realism.
Yeah, it's there.
Poetic,
it's there.
Yeah. I can agree.
And so for this, I thought, okay, there's going to be a heart there. And I knew that it told the story of one person at three different stages in their life. And you kind of get that from the poster, right? But I didn't know exactly what to expect. And I knew Mahershala Ali was in it, but I didn't know who Exactly. Like, I didn't know if he was a figure in that person's life or if he was that character at one of his certain ages. And I didn't know really, like, I knew Janelle Monáe and Naomi Harris and whatnot were in it, but I didn't know, like, how they fit in. Do you know what I mean?
You. No, I certainly understand. So let's go ahead and let's talk about the film specifically. Now, the film itself, as we've kind of already brought up, is the fact that this is dealing with one young man's life at three pivotal times. One as a young boy. I like to think of it as at like 9, 19, and 29, or like, you know, that there's a 10-year difference between the films. Now,
yeah, it makes sense. Yeah.
I could be wrong on that, but I think that's pretty close. I mean, he was in high school, so maybe like 6, 16, and 26.
Yeah, I mean, I could see it as like 1996, 2006, 2016. Like that, yeah. That to me fits with what I saw in the film. You see Mahershala Ali's character, Juan, has either a cell phone or a pager, but it's not like a modern cell phone pager type thing. And then you see I kind of wore similar clothes when I was in high school. So I'm like, okay, that looks familiar to me.
You were in the cargo pants?
Yeah. Like that made sense to me. And then obviously like catching up in current era. Yeah.
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 Well, officially, according to the credits, one Kevin is age 9, the other Kevin is 16. And then it doesn't give a age for...
Yeah, it that makes sense. That jives with what I was feeling. Yeah.
Also,
I was just saying close.
Yeah.
Close enough.
I also find it very interesting that the film is titled or subtitled into three segments. One is, and they're all names that is given to this character. One is Little, as this young man, as a child. Sharon, his Christian name, as the middle. And then Black as the adult variation of this character. What did you think about the subtitles of this film?
I like that. I like that a lot. And here's why. So there's all three names have different connotations at different times in his life. Mm-hmm. When he's in the first act, his given name is Chiron, but his friends call him Little, right? And he says, "My friends call me Little." Or he says, "People call me Little."
Because we've made it very clear that he really doesn't have friends. Right, we'll talk about Kevin in just a little bit. Yeah. But I definitely see what you're getting.
People call me Little, so that's kind of an affectionate nickname. When he's in high school, he goes by Chiron, but Little is kind of the insulting nickname. Like that's what the bullies call him to taunt him. And I thought that was interesting because it kind of flips on his head. We saw him get bullied a little bit as a kid, but now we see that this is kind of taken on, like this is part of his daily existence that he's going through. And then Kevin gives him the nickname Black, and he doesn't start immediately going by Black. In fact, he thinks it's kind of strange that like who just goes around giving people nicknames? That's weird.
That's true.
But that's kind of what Kevin does. And then later on, in the third act, when he's in his adult persona, he becomes Black, just as Juan at the beginning of the film talked about having the nickname Blue because of the story from his childhood growing up in Cuba. And so I kind of saw a symmetry there, Black and Blue. Obviously, Chiron has been beat up a bit, but he goes as far as to have Black as his license plate tag.
We'll get into that.
Yeah, yeah.
But I want to give Caesar a chance to chime in on this.
Sure.
Because I think...
Well, one of the reasons Eric was interested in me coming to the show for Moonlight is because I have a history... with this film where it watching this movie for me personally, you know, took me with a lot of flashbacks. Now, I don't know if I mentioned this before when we last did our podcast episode for The Hateful Eight and Django Unchained. But I grew up in some bad neighborhoods in the Houston area. And then I left and lived in Brooklyn, New York, back when it was considered a concrete jungle. And then when I came back and went to, you know, college here in Texas. And, you know, Eric and I, we've been friends for years. So obviously people that we know, we're going to, you know, meet each other or associate with. And I was friends with not only African-Americans, but, you know, African-Americans that happen to be gay. So, you know, when you're friends with people, you end up opening up and you tell each other's, you know, your war stories. So as years pass and now I'm sitting here watching Moonlight, it was like a flashback to everything, everything I experienced, the things I dealt with my friends, things I saw in those neighborhoods. And there's an interesting concept that you have where you're talking about who's giving people these nicknames. And I noticed that when you live in certain neighborhoods, especially in the neighborhoods that, you know, Chiron grew up in, you know, everyone goes by a nickname. Yeah, like for me, my nickname was Van Damme. And the only reason they gave me that was because I had long hair at that time, you know, like when the movie Hard Target came out, and I used to do mixed martial arts, and this was before mixed martial arts was popular. And I remember I got into a fight in school with a guy, and it was two guys after me, and I used what I knew from martial arts using my legs. So consider I used to wear my shirts tucked in as well. You know, there goes the nickname.
But can you do the splits? That's the thing.
Yeah, at that time I can. Now it's like, forget it.
Yeah.
So by the time, you know, I, you know, went to college, you know, obviously it's a very different atmosphere, and everyone, you know, they're more, you know, inclined to really pursue higher education, and they want to really explore their mind. And the one thing I noticed that was very interesting is that people didn't want to go by nicknames. They wanted to be addressed by their real names. So,
and then
so
later, and then later in life, you join a podcast and go by like John O'Lobster or Lobster. Yeah.
No.
Weird, right?
Yeah, no. But that's a moniker that you need.
I chose that.
That's more of a stage name.
Yeah.
Right. And, or a hacker handle. I think of Black as that's his street name. Like that's his right. Tough name. He's hard. Mm-hmm. And he's a tough guy. Like you see him working out. I mean, obviously he's in really good shape. Like no one would call him little, right? Like unless they're just being ironic, which I actually kind of enjoy, because his name has ironic.
Yeah, like those big guys that name Tiny.
Yeah,
they're like 6'8". Yeah.
I kind of enjoyed that aspect of it, and it made sense to me.
Well, the thing is that one of the things I find very interesting here is that normally when you have a film where you're having the character's name title be the subtitles of the film, is that you add up to the point of the Christian name becoming the one at the end, because you are becoming that person. Yeah. And yet it's here is that the Christian name is the middle, and then you have a given name or a nickname as the name that is him as an adult.
Yeah.
And what I find very interesting here is that this is a film from the beginning of the film. It constantly refers to toughening up and to building armor. And what I find very interesting here is that Black is yet just another piece of armor because it doesn't give people his real name. On top of that, considering these physical changes that occur to Chiron from childhood to adult.
I'll go you one further on that one, which is very early on, Juan says, don't let anyone else decide who you are. And his Christian name is still a name that someone else has given him.
Yeah, well, it's his mother that gives him.
Right, his mother. And I think there's an intentional distancing of himself from his mother because of what he goes through as a child and as a young adult in high school. And I think that when he talks about he goes to juvie for, you know, busting a chair over the guy's head in class.
Like a WWE move?
Yeah. He goes away for that.
If you're a white guy, you'd just be given a contract from Vince McMahon, you know, as a black child.
But after that, he intentionally becomes Black. Like he does, like it's not that someone else in his sphere of influence gives him that nickname. He takes that one piece from the life that he left behind, which is, I think, because Kevin is kind of important to him. Well, and that's also he wants to emulate Juan. I mean, he goes out and gets the same car.
Well, he gets the same car, the same job, yeah. Although he doesn't get this same girlfriend, which we'll talk about in just a minute. But I do want to just tie this back to Kevin again, because Kevin was the first one to say, you need to toughen up. He's the one, as a child, was looked like you're...
with him, yeah.
Yeah. So in a way, this is, you know, as much as he's listening to Juan his entire life, he's also in a way listening to Kevin, which we'll definitely be getting into when we get into the final act. But yeah, let's go ahead. Let's talk about the women in Sherwin's life, because we have two specifically. We have his mother, and then we have Teresa, which I find very interesting that you have his biological mother, the crack whore, which is really so cliche, But you know, she's called Paula, and yet the good one, the mother, is Teresa. Mother Teresa, see where we're going here?
Yeah.
See where we're going here?
Huh? Yes.
Yeah. But
saint. Yes.
Well, she is a saint. I mean, she, you know, whenever he's in trouble, she's there for him. She lets him crash at her house.
She shows him how to make a bed.
Even after. Yeah. You know, she's as much a mother, probably even more of a mother than his own mother is.
Yeah.
That's
very, very true.
Well, I mean, if you think about it, the main theme of this movie is identity.
Yes.
And when you look at Chiron, you know, it's sad because even the way how those chapters are set up when they're introducing his different stages of life, you know, the boy never had an identity of his own. He always had someone claiming his identity. Like in the beginning where the kids are chasing him and using derogatory terms for homosexuals towards him when he's a child. And then, you know, the name Little.
Mm-hmm.
It's already belittling, you know. So when you look at the women in his life, they're already creating another identity as well.
But I've also found kind of interesting here, though, that Chiron, while he definitely has these two female figures, they really don't play a very strong part in his life. I mean, his mother is an antagonist of sorts. But
yeah, I mean, I think
she's.
Yeah, I think to kind of answer that, this is about, I think, Chiron forming his masculine identity. What kind of man is he going to be? And so while both Teresa and his own mother, Paula, in a way form maternal caretaker figures, neither one becomes his role model. His role model really is Juan, and also in a way Kevin. Juan and Kevin are the influences on him forming his own male identity. And again, that's not to say that those other figures aren't important. I just don't think that's what the movie is getting at.
Yeah, but there's some truth right there where he does feel comfortable with Juan, because you remember there's a scene where they're driving and the windows roll down by, you know, Chiron's end, and he has his hand out playing with the air. He's enjoying himself being a child.
Yeah.
And that's already shows as a sign of comfort. But one thing is that if you look closely about Juan, you know, even in the conversations, everything they had, he embraced who Chiron was, knowing what his true identity is. Or what would be the future be for him?
Well, I mean,
the same thing as Kevin. And I think that's one of the reasons why maybe the males were a little bit stronger compared to the female. But when it comes to some kind of comfort or safety net, there was Teresa.
Well, the thing is that when I first saw the film, and we get to this, to the swimming scene where Juan teaches Chiron to swim. When I was watching it the first time, I was honestly thinking that this was basically the film. This is a film talking about the roles, or especially kind of that connection between men and boys in African American communities specifically. Because I did find it very interesting that here you are, you have this male figure who's not of blood, who has no familial connection to Chiron. We'll find out there is another connection that does happen, but it's one that is actually very painful between the two. But that you know, but that one takes this boy in and becomes a father figure, becomes a father of sorts, even though he has no connection to this boy outside of just these moments. And that Kevin and that relationship with Kevin, especially in the first two acts, we'll talk about the third act in just a little bit, but that closeness, that intimacy between these two men, these two young men specifically, that we're seeing these bonds that are taking form, that Sharon is making with these other figures, that we will that we'll see, especially in the third act, when we see him with his protege, that there's a distance, even though he's messing with him and he's kind of being that he's kind of laughing with him, but he's still distant from that protege, that he doesn't allow others to connect with. And I think that the film is talking about how African-American men specifically, and perhaps I don't know if it was meant intentionally to kind of to single out gay African-American men, have to kind of put up this appearance of masculinity, this appearance of strength specifically.
I think you're right. I think you're getting to the heart of it, which is what is male identity? What are the characteristics of being male? Mm-hmm. And I think what this film is interested in getting at is men are fathers, men are brothers, men are lovers, men are fighters. You know, like it kind of takes you through all of the different, you know, men are sons, I guess, is a, you know, another thing you can add in there. And I think
that's
I think it's really what the film is kind of meditating on. And again, I think it is talking about characters in an all African-American cast, but I don't know if these are stories. And, you know, I would argue that it's not, because this film won Best Picture at the Oscars. These aren't stories unique to African-American communities. I think these are universal truths that the film is getting at. And so I think it's really interesting seeing the way the film kind of constructs those roles and then breaks them down, right? Because you could look at Juan and say he's a gangster. You could look at...
but is he really? Because we don't ever see him do anything violent. He's a dealer, definitely. But
right. He's a manager of dealers. He's middle management in the scheme of dealing drugs. He's not out on the street corner selling, and he's also not the Heisenberg either. He's the one who is distributing and collecting the money, right?
But is he a villain in that sense? I mean,
does he carry a gun?
Probably.
We see it for sure.
Yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, he's probably a figure who is feared and respected, but also
we see him being respected. I mean, the first scene we see him is when he goes to see his protege. You know, there's definitely respect. There's no bullshit between him and his.
Yeah, and he's also kind of a, you know, he's known in the community, but he's not. I guess to kind of contrast with the character he plays on Luke Cage, he's not like the supervillain of the neighborhood, right? Like. He's not the cottonmouth of the neighborhood.
Most of the law-abiding people would be happy if he were gone, but at least he doesn't shoot the place up.
Right.
There's a nobility, right? There's a nobility almost.
Yeah. I mean, the only time that he's ever challenged about his profession is with Paula when we find out that she's kind of has a crack habit on top of. Very promiscuous.
She smokes it and he sells it. Yeah.
And
she's a paying customer, and that's the relationship. Yeah.
But at the same time, though, I like that entire confrontation between Juan and Paula is so I don't want to say it's unnerving, but it definitely is tension. There's a lot of tension.
It's a very tense. But you notice also that the man that she's with does not get involved at all.
Yeah, because first off, she's crazy. And I'm pretty sure that he's still hoping to get laid.
He knows who won. I'm sure he knows who Juan is as well, and knows that that's not someone that you mess with.
But he doesn't come after her. He doesn't do anything to her. He doesn't show any violence or menace to her. All he does really is basically say, hey, you can't light up here. I mean, considering considering that he's supposed to be kind of a badass, he doesn't have to be a badass. He can kind of go back to the Godfather. He doesn't have to be.
Right.
You know, he can do as much by just being polite than he would be with threatening violence.
Yeah, but you know, if you think about the attachment he's getting with Chiron and seeing that his mother's doing that and not, you know, being a mother, but
I think that's going to affect
them too.
Yeah.
But did anyone else feel that there was a strange shift with Paula? Because the first time we see her, she's in these scrubs and she's...
It just seemed like something like...
The first time we see her, she chastised Chiron for staying out all night. You know,
she
no TV.
Him. Yeah,
yeah.
I mean, she comes off as a very responsible mother the first time we see her, and then all of a sudden goes crack, like.
Yep. No. But
zero to crack in like 5 seconds. Like,
no. But if you pay close attention to her appearance, and anyone who, like I say, growing up in those neighborhoods, when you see people are doing hard drugs, you could see the changes already in their lips, their face. Their fatigue, anything. So when I see that scene...
She's just come off a shift.
No. I didn't see that like exhausted from a shift because I used to work in a clinic. So, I know from my own experience or other people or even the ones when I did work in a clinic who did drugs after work. You know, I know. So when I saw it, I looked like, okay, she's in her stages already. I don't know what she's doing, but she's in her stages.
Yeah, and then, I guess the other thing is... that Chiron didn't go home that night, and you know it's not like the police are after him. It's not like you know there's an Amber Alert or whatever. It's where were you? You didn't come. You know, there's a level of she's concerned and upset, but she hasn't really. It seems like gone out of her way to. I don't know. Again, the film is structured in a way that there isn't space for every detail, right? Like you don't find out how Juan died.
Well, yeah. But what, going back to the mother in the scene when we first introduced and she's on the scrubs. Now, if you take a notice, like Chiron did not mind spending a night at Juan's house.
Yeah.
He felt like, you know, no one's going to pay attention. Who cares? He had this kind of attitude. So I have a feeling that his mother has been going out at nights. And part just came in the morning, not to check on her son, maybe partially to check on her son, but to really get ready to go to work. Maybe. And this goes back to the stages.
But why would she be in scrubs going home if she's going home to get ready for work? Because
No. Because
work.
In that scene, you know, it was already like the next day, not like...
That's right, because it's in the morning. She had been... And we've seen that she go that she's out at night because we see him getting himself ready for school in the morning.
But that scene is like for later on, like after. Like not just the morning, his day was.
I don't think in Act 2, I don't think that she has the job. In Act 2.
Yeah. No. In Act 2, she's done. I mean, the thing is is that we definitely see that
she's
progression.
She's got a full-time career, and it ain't
going and it's in crack. But I
think in terms of the way the film's structured, you don't get these details filled in. And I think that's okay. And, like, we can obviously sit here as film critiquers and try to figure out what's going on between the lines. But the film, I don't think, is interested in necessarily spelling everything out for you. You don't need to know whether Chiron's mom is not present at home because she's working too many overtime shifts just to pay the bills and not really paying attention to him.
Well,
except
when
for when
she does pay attention to him, she screams at him, as we saw.
She grounds him. She goes off on him and things like that. So for whatever reason, like Caesar said, Chiron is okay not being at home, right? Like he's cool with it.
Yeah, it's like he doesn't feel like he'll be missed, which is sad. But
Well, let's talk about, because you did bring up something, and I don't want to lose that. is that the best character in the film is gone after 25 minutes.
Who's the best character in the film?
What the hell? Juan. Juan is gone after 25 minutes. They kill him off. We don't know how he dies. We don't know. He just disappears.
Yeah.
I mean, and on top of that, you know, they kind of mentioned, hey, you know, we remember Juan, but there's nothing really to signify the importance outside of what we saw in the first act regarding.
So here's my question. And Kent, feel free to chime in anytime, buddy. There's a sense that his absence is keenly felt. I think that Chiron in Act Two is not, I mean, he doesn't have that anchor. He's reverted back to where we saw him before Juan started to draw him out a bit. He doesn't talk. He doesn't, you know, he looks down. He doesn't connect with people. He's having problems with getting bullied. I have a suspicion that when Chiron as Little started hanging out with Juan, the bullies probably didn't bother him too much.
I think they did, but I think that Little,
you guys have
care.
Seen A Bronx Tale, right? Like there's kind of this feeling of, yeah, you don't mess with Chiron. Chiron's okay. Like he's with me. And I kind of,
no one ever says
No. Actually, I know I agree with Lobster in this, because later on in the, you know, in the second act when it's called Chiron, there's the guys who's taunting him. They said, "Oh, you know, yeah, they're talking about Teresa.
Juan's not
and they're talking about
anymore,
Juan.
Yeah,
Juan's
not,
so
they
probably,
talk about Juan, but they don't say, hey, he's no longer around.
No. But that attitude, the way they're giving the history, that's enough to say, you know.
And
you know,
I kind of get
now
that.
Now, game on. I could mess with you.
Yeah,
you know?
And I kind of get that, because when you see him in Act Two, he really has regressed to where he was before Juan kind of entered his life. So I'll argue that Juan's absence in the rest of the film speaks to his presence when he was there, right? I think if Juan were there kind of guiding Chiron and looking out for him, we wouldn't see his life take the trajectory that it does. Now, maybe it would. Maybe Juan would take him under his wing and train him how to be a drug dealer. But I don't see that happening. I don't think that's what Juan kind of wanted for him. But Chiron chose...
Again,
purely supposition. You're right. But I'm guessing. Because Juan's whole thesis is you don't let anyone tell you who you're going to be. So I don't think he's going to say, you know, let me show you how to be a drug dealer. He's going to say, you know, stay in school. Here's how you deal with bullies, this, and this. You know, if somebody comes at you, here's how you handle it.
I'm just going to ask a quick question and then you can get back to your point, but I just want to tie this in right quick. Do you think that perhaps because that Chiron took the drug dealing job that he does later on, is a connection to him with Juan?
Yeah, 100%. 100%. He models his life Juan's later on. The only father figure that he's had – and ironically, the father figure who said, you know, don't let anyone tell you who to be, find your own path. He goes and literally follows that path. And again, I'm going to point out the car because I think that's the most symbolism the movie can really throw at us.
Okay. Well, when we talk about masculinity, especially identity, you could say the car is a relation to masculinity. Yeah. And also to the connection both as men.
It's a literal metaphor for... the size of something, right?
Like but this is a thing. Okay, now going back to like we talked about, the main theme is identity. Now this is the thing that's, I find a certain conflict between, you know, well, okay, let's put it this way. You know, sadly, you know, what brings certain conflict towards, you know, people is that, you know, in life, you know, our personal identities are like, you know, they're socially, you know, established.
Right.
So, you know, and
there's a pecking order that tells you where you have to fit in.
Where you have to fit in. So let's say for someone from a decent background, you know, when they watch Moonlight, there's a certain perspective, like what you just said, that, okay, of course he's going to follow that path. But I look at Chiron's situation, especially what happened in the last chapter, in chapter two, by the ending when he, you know, went away, went to jail and all that stuff. It was more not just dispositional, but it was situational and systemic. And these three factors played a huge part of his identity and the choices he had to make. So I don't feel like he became a drug dealer to emulate. I felt like he became a drug dealer because that was the only choice he knew he was going to make any ends meet.
Well, yeah, on top of that, he is coming out of prison. So there is that.
Right. I mean,
yeah, but you remember the story he said once he, you know, the adult. Yeah. When he was an adult, he said
he had an opportunity. You know, he applied himself and he rose up. Like he got in that position because he was good at it, not because you
know. And it was the connections he made when he was in prison as a young teenager.
And, again, I think that if you look at the trajectory of Act Two, he realizes that you know the bullies aren't just going to stop bothering him. Today he got beat up. You know, who mm-hmm. knows what tomorrow is going to bring. And so he makes the and obviously he's angry, right? Like you see him when he's walking into the school, you know, he's slamming doors, he's kind of barging in. Like he's got that in his head that that's what he's going to do. And for him, I think at that point it's survival. His mom's not going to watch out for him. Teresa can't really do anything. It's not acceptable within the confines of that culture that he's going to press charges and you know, rat these guys out or narc on them. So the only thing that he has at his disposal is to do more violence to them than they can do to him.
Yeah, you got a point there. Now, this is a story I want to share. When I was living in those bad neighborhoods, I remember my mom, she bought me a very nice sweater, you know, for the winter. And it was a nice hoodie. And I was wearing it and I was walking down the street and there was a group of eight guys just standing around. And they say, hey, we like your sweater. And, you know, me being a little naive and I was very young. I was like, I think like 11 years old or going on 12. And I was like, oh, thank you. Like being stupid. And they're like, no, we really like your sweater. And they were circling around me. And I was like, so where did you get it? And once again, being a little naive, I said, well, I think my mother got it at Macy's or JCPenney's. Maybe you could tell that to your mom and she could happily buy you, you know, your own sweater. You know, once again, stupid. But I wasn't realizing what they were trying to do. And then the guy, you know, I was trying to walk away and the guy said, no, you don't get it. I really like your sweater. And I was like, okay. And then he was, I guess he got frustrated, like I wasn't getting it, that all of those eight guys end up jumping me. And I was trying to get away. And I remember, like, they even, you know, I almost successfully ran away, but then they got a hold of the hoodie part and they pulled it all the way back and they ripped my sweater apart. And I remember I'm trying to fight my way out and all these eight guys are jumping me, scratching me. And then they picked me up and they threw me in one of those bushes that's very spiky. Mm-hmm. And now I'm like, you know, getting up and I'm trying to figure out how to get out. And some of these guys are throwing rocks at me. And, you know, luckily at that time, you know, I was really good at running track and stuff like that, that I just ran as fast as I could when I found an opening. And I remember going home literally with no sweater because it was ripped off my, you know, back, all my shirt torn. I'm bleeding. I have bruises everywhere. And, you know, I remember in the movie, when he's in the principal office and he just breaks down and cries. And then later on, he comes back and he becomes violent. I know that feeling because after what happened to me, I would realize, okay, if I'm going to live in this neighborhood, I got to hit hard.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's when I started learning more about mixed martial arts. So when I went to school, you know, if someone looked at me or they wanted to challenge me, I went first head on fast and hard. Now, I'm not advocating violence, but I'm just saying that it's easy in those type of environments.
And it comes from a place of, and this is kind of what I'm hearing from your story. Yeah, and thank you for sharing that with us.
Yeah, yeah.
That it comes from a place of the helplessness of he doesn't have those options. His options are really to hit harder.
But what part of that is that Terrell, because, you know, Terrell is the one that he hits with the chair, but Terrell was the one who got Kevin to do the whole
Kevin was just as much a victim in that situation as Tyrone was. Kevin was just as much a victim of Tyrell in that situation as Tyrone was. But I mean the bully. I just kind of called him the bully, or in my head I was like, okay, Little Wayne he was the mastermind between that. And you saw the scene where he's just circling, and you see him just circling the crowd. That's him picking his target.
He definitely was.
Yeah, and again, what would have happened if Kevin said no?
Well, Kevin would have been not beat the shit down. I mean, it was like Kevin.
Well, it
says.
Depends. It depends.
No. Kevin basically says, like, look, if you show any weakness whatsoever, they're going to come after you.
Well, no, but it really depends, because if their guys are really cool with Kevin and they really like him a lot, then they'll probably let that slide one time. But the next time,
Terrell has an iron grip, and we see that. Mm-hmm. You know, his crew is tight with him, and if they went against Terrell, Terrell would have.
Well, like I said, it goes back at the pins, so it goes back to why he ended up fighting Chiron.
No, I get that, but his question was,
what if he said no? And I'm telling you, he would. If they really like them, they'll let him slide that one time. But the next time, he has to hit harder.
No, because if his crew had let...
I'm telling you from experience, from witnessing
No, Terrell has an iron grip. The whole point of this, the whole point of this is that Terrell has to show dominance. So if his crew says, we'll let you pass, when Terrell wants it very clear that he has control, he would hit one of them hard enough so that they would realize he is the top dog and they will do as he says.
Yes, from that movie's perspective, but in real life, I'm telling you,
I think the point
if he said no, and I'm just telling him, like, if he did say no, this is what would have been if he really liked him.
What I'm trying to get at here is I don't think Kevin had a choice, and I think Chiron knew that although Kevin hit them and Kevin hit him and that hurt Chiron, that Kevin is the one that has to do the bidding of Tyrell in this situation. But he doesn't blame Kevin for that.
No, I don't think he blames him either.
I think he thinks that it's Kevin that is doing it instead of someone else, because there's still that connection. As we saw prior to this.
And to be fair, I think Kevin pulls his punch a bit.
Yeah.
Because he's begging him, please stay down. Please stay down.
Yeah.
But it looks like, let's go ahead and let's talk about this relationship between Chiron and Kevin, because this is our pivotal relationship, right? This is the relationship that we're really supposed to care about the most.
Well, we're supposed to care about all the relationships, but this is the through line of the film. And to be fair, I think what this film keeps in its back pocket in a really good way is you know that his friendship with Kevin and later on when they're hanging out smoking the blunt and things go a little bit further, I don't think you necessarily see this as being the through line of the film. You're hooked with Juan and you see that this is about having a father figure or parental figure in your life and what maybe parenting means to a kid. But really, this film is about his relationship with Kevin. And I think that the film, at least for me, the first time watching it, surprised me with that.
Well, it surprised me too. But the thing was, is that the second time around and then all subsequent viewings from that, is that it actually sets up really early.
Yeah.
That there's a relationship between Sherwin and Kevin. In fact, what I found very interesting was that the scene where the kids are playing with the paper mache soccer ball, is that at first, because we see Chiron, and then it shows a group of kids with this girl in the center. It centers the girl in the center. So you'd think that, okay, well, maybe he's thinking about this cute girl that's there. And then it slightly pans over to Kevin. It's slightly, just a little bit at a time. And then it centers on Kevin. And at that particular point, then we have that connection between Chiron and Kevin, because the next scene that we have are the two of them playing off with one another away from the other kids, and this is where that relationship really starts to take form in the film, which again it says subtleness, and I'm going to give Barry Jenkins a lot in the kind of subtlety that he puts into the little intricate things that we got Sharon. There's places where he goes a little broad, and we've talked about that, especially when it comes to Paula. I think he gets her way broad, and we didn't need it to be that broad with her. But the relationships that he has with Kevin and with himself specifically, it's very subtle, so that you can kind of understand where he's coming from in those particular relationships. And I thought very interesting is that Sharon is a very reactive character. He doesn't really proactively do anything, with the exception of the chair. And I guess we'll also talk about him going to see Kevin at the end of the film. Everything else he's reacting to, like with the scene where his mother's screaming at him. What does he do? He just sits, he stands there and takes it. When something bad is happening to him, he stands there and takes it.
Yeah, but that has to do with, in reality, he's just an introvert.
Well, he is an introvert, but that's a part of his character. And that's one of the things that the film understands that about the character. And so it puts him in places where he has to react. And then so that when he does proact, when he does actually have to do something, it's striking. When he hits Terrell with the chair, we're startled by that because we know it's going to come, but it's startling to see him do it. When he decides that he's going to go and see Kevin, we know he's going to do it, but it's still surprising because we normally just see him just take it, just accept it. Instead, he is pursuing. He is doing something proactive. So it makes that proactiveness more pivotal, more important.
Yeah.
So that's what I found very interesting about how the film takes that character, and especially how Barry Jenkins films Sharon in all three films.
I hate to be this person, but Kent, were you surprised?
Oh. About which part? The whole thing?
Yeah, I mean, now we're kind of getting to third act stuff where you realize that this movie is about Sharon and Kevin's relationship. Yeah, it's about them coming together, which is where the film leaves us at the end. Were you surprised on your first viewing to see that be the case, or did you kind of have other feelings about what the message of the movie was going to be?
Originally, I thought it was going to be the Juan Chiron's story, and then it jumped forward, killed Juan, and it's like, okay, teenage years, what happens? I did not actually expect Kevin to come back in later in life.
Well, I think that
we jump to an adulthood and we see a completely different stress strain from there.
Well, we only have one scene with Kevin, which I think is the reason why it seems like it's a kind of...
Well, kind of two things, because, when childhood and then, teenage years.
Well, there's only one scene.
One scene when he's a child, you have him come back. The first thing that you hear is him bragging about having sex with a girl when you see him again, which is kind of an interesting take on that. And it's interesting. I love the sex dream that Sharon has, and you... Like, at first, you're like, okay, he's having the sex dream. Is he fantasizing about the girl? And you're like, no, it's the Kevin part of it is what's in there for him. And then you have Kevin
talking about Freudian overtones.
Yeah, very Freudian. You have Kevin call Sharon as an adult. Like, he calls, and originally Sharon thinks it's his mother calling again.
Yeah.
Well, my thing, okay, now you mentioned the mother. I have a question for everyone. Do you hate the mother? Or can you understand the mother?
Oh, no. I mean, you can't hate the mother. You can hate her addiction. You can hate her weakness. You can hate the fact that she was a crappy mother to Sharon. And it's clear that at the end of the film, she is doing what she can to try to make up for that, right? Like, and I think the fact that she is clearly electively staying at the rehab institution, like she's saying, like, no, I've completed my course of treatment, I can leave, but I'm going to stay here and work and try to help others. You can take that one of two ways. One is that she, like, is trying to make a penance and make up for it. Or two, she doesn't trust herself to leave.
She's lying and she's still stuck there. She just wants to make him feel better.
Yeah, or that, but whatever.
Yeah, it's possible. That is possible.
Yeah, but I think the whatever the takeaway is, you know that she's she's there because she doesn't want to let Chiron down again. She wants to try to, in some way, make up for the pain that she's caused him.
Well, this is the thing that's kind of depressing, and it kind of relates to in real life. You know, there's so many people in their younger years, from family members to friendships, that they're psychologically scarred, and it had a tremendous effect that even, let's say, 10 or 15 years, 20 years, whatever it takes, they meet again, they realize, oh, it wasn't really personal. But regardless if it wasn't personal, the effect it had. So when you look at the scene where he does, you know, the adult Chiron meets his mother, I do feel that she's telling the truth, because when you look from the actress, what we've seen, you know, from her facial expression, from, you know, how she looks, and yes, you can see, yes, she is cleaning up, and there's a more chance that she will try to fulfill, fulfill her needs with him as a son and a mother.
I guess for me specifically, when it comes to between Paula and Chiron, the thing is that she really doesn't do anything to atone. She basically says, I've changed. We see that she's right. in rehab. But the thing is that she doesn't do anything overtly for him.
And you can argue that at this point,
he doesn't want anything from her.
There's nothing she can do. I mean,
staying away might be the best.
Yeah, and that's what she's doing. She's staying at this place. She's staying out of his life. She's, you know, obviously inviting him to come visit, but at the same time, what could she do? How could she? She can't give those years back.
Yeah, it's just too much.
She can't take back what she did and said. So I think at this point she's doing the best that she can to, if not make up for the past, then at least try not to repeat the mistakes of the past.
But did you notice that she never says that she's proud of him? I mean, she says that she loves him, but she never says that she's proud of him.
Yeah,
now, remember that one of the things that I found very interesting is they mute her from saying one particular word. And yes. I have a feeling I know exactly what that word was that she screamed at him.
Yeah. Yeah.
And to me, though, I think it's very interesting that she talks about love, and she might even try really, really think that she's trying to love him. But I don't know if
And that's where we as the audience get to write Act 4.
That's right. And that's what I do appreciate the film for doing that in that sense. And because the things that aren't said are as important as the things that are said. And I don't want things tied.
Right. And they lived happily ever after. You get the kind of the title cards over the still frames on the end, you know, and so-and-so went on to become the first black lawyer to argue in front of the Supreme Court or something, you know, something like that, you know.
But this is the thing, you know, the way I look at it, when it comes to the audience, you know, like you and me, everyone who saw it, they're part of the audience, your relationship towards how you feel about the mother is really, I think, you know, psychologically, there's going to be two things. Either you look at her as a health issue, or you look at her as a criminal issue. And then you have to look at your own issues with what you have with your own family. And then you could say, no, I really do hate her because I know this and that. You know, it's easier to pour more judgment, more opinions. You know, does that make sense?
And I think for what it's worth at this point, the film, you know, the film kind of earns your pity for her. At this point, you pity her. At this point, you know, you may still be angry about the lack of attention or the lack of care that she showed to Chiron at the beginning. But I think the film ends on a hopeful enough note that you realize that whatever damage she did doesn't prevent him from finding some measure of happiness.
All I will say.
Do we think this ends on a happy note or no?
I say 50-50.
I'm going to agree with Caesar on this one. I will say this, though. The thing is that while I'm watching Naomi Harris's character, and understand, I love Naomi Harris as an actress.
She's great. Miss Money and others.
I've been fascinated by her since 28 Days Later. I've been a fan of hers for that long. And Naomi Harris is an actress I really appreciate. And the thing is that as I was watching this performance, I couldn't help but think about another Academy Award winning performance from a few years ago with a completely despicable mother.
Precious.
Yes.
I thought you were going to mention Precious.
The thing is that because Moonlight kind of is walking in that same line as Precious, and except, but the thing is that where Precious is cynical and, you know, it's kind of filled with very mean and cruel people, this is a movie where even the most cruelest people are human. And I think I appreciate about that about the film is that the cruelty that you see isn't from just being menacing. It's not just because people are petty and mean. It's because something is wrong in their lives and something is missing in their lives. And so it humanizes that cruelty a little bit. And so while I'm watching this final scene with Paula, part of me does kind of understand where you're coming from with the pity, but a part of me can't. And the thing is that I love the fact that
I think that's okay because in a way that 100% mirrors how Chiron feels.
Yeah, because Chiron is Chiron feels the exact same way.
Pities her, part of him can't let go. And that's the frailty of human relationships, right? I mean, we're stuck no matter what.
Well, this ties us back to the Kevin scenes at the end, which let's put it this way. That in itself, I would probably pay the price of admission just the final moments between. If it was just a short film of Chiron going to meet Kevin and all the scenes leading up to the final scene, this is possibly some of the most beautiful romantic filmmaking I think I've seen in a very long time. Not in the sense that it's trying to be flowery, but the sense that it's trying to understand these two characters and where they come from. And especially because you've seen that relationship form between them from the beginning of the film, for it to come to this, I did find myself truly engaged in these scenes. And I'm curious to think what everyone thinks, but I'm going to start with Caesar first because I know his answer. And I think he says it probably better than I can.
Well, man, okay. Well, for me, it's really the it's not only that whole scene, but it's really the last 6 minutes that made it for me. Because before then, there are certain flaws the movie has, but not to the point where they're horrible flaws. It's just like I said, the crack mama. I mean, that's been done 100 times before. But and for the most part, I was already thinking to myself, okay, this is a solid movie, and I don't know if I'm going to think of it as very good or great. But it was the last literally 6 minutes where they're in that kitchen. And that, for me, sucked me in. And not only sucked me in, but the whole point that this movie exists, the reason why Barry Jenkins adapted this from the play, is in those last 6 minutes. And for me personally, it was heartbreaking. Like, I literally wanted to burst out in tears because right there you realize that Chiron never got to live his life as a human being. He never got to explore who he really was as a person. You know?
Do you think at that end scene he's still a virgin?
No.
No?
I think prison would have probably...
I mean, there's always stereotypes that you can kind of put on that. And I think that
like to think that he fought the good fight.
That's not what I'm going to try to say here. I'm going to try to say is that if given the choice.
Well, you know what? Wait. You know what? I just realized it. I think our answer was there because do you remember in the end of the movie, he did say, you're the only guy I ever felt comfortable. So, no, I guess he is a virgin.
He says you're the only guy who ever touched me. You're the only person that I ever, was with intimately.
Yes.
And I think that intimate is the operative word because there may have been people that he had to fuck to get where he is.
I agree.
You know what I mean? Like, just as like a practical tool.
I think he built his armor. I think he built his body to protect him.
Yeah. But I think in terms of who he let his guard down for, in terms of who he was intimate with, it was Kevin, and that was it.
Well,
and,
I mean, look at the final shot. The final shot of him is having him have his head on Kevin's shoulder. That and complete I think that under vulnerability.
That is, you're right. This is the case of something that very few movies effectively do, which is have the final shot be the most important. I think very few films can build over 111 minutes to having your final scene and your final shot be, this is what we've worked all this time to get to.
You like The Godfather?
Yeah, you guys just rattled off a couple, but I think that's Rogue One, you know, whatever. Yeah. that's literally, this is a film that has told us this entire story of Chiron's life, and yet it has built to this moment of honesty, and that is the key moment of the film.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really masterful, the way Barry Jenkins lets that happen. And I think it's really masterful. Again, you mentioned that this was adapted from a script for the stage and developed into a film. One of my takeaways from this film is how few words per minute of dialogue are actually spoken.
Yeah.
How the film takes its time. And obviously it helps that you have a protagonist who isn't particularly verbose. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, this film lets each scene breathe and lets each moment breathe in a way that you arrive naturally to this moment. And at the same time, I don't think the film suffers from a pacing problem, because every word that's spoken is meaningful. You're hanging on every word of the film. And so it doesn't feel slow at any point. I think that's really masterful, at least for me, just watching it once. Maybe that gets tiresome on repeated viewing, but just watching it once, I was right there with the characters. And it made sense all the way through to me, the way it was structured.
Well, I think Moonlight, especially the ending, it's going to be one of those movies that they build it up so well that I think it will always have an impact. Like what we mentioned, like The Godfather, that final ending.
Are you putting putting Moonlight up to Godfather style?
No, I'm just talking about like the emotional impact. You know, in the end of The Godfather, you know, y'all all seen The Godfather. Yeah, yeah.
Yes, we've talked about it.
Okay. Sorry. Yeah, that's a stupid ass question.
Been a while, but we've been there.
Okay, but you remember, she was happy that Michael told her the truth, supposedly, and she's in the next room all smiling and realizing that it was a fucking lie, and the door closes. That was really amazing. It was like, you know, so every time you watch that movie, the whole movie, when you get to that scene, it always feels fresh. So I feel it's the same thing with Moonlight. You know, when you watch this arc and when you get to that point, you will always appreciate that punch.
All right. Well, one of the things we've talked about with La La Land, and I think that no one disagreed with me on this, is the fact that the relationship between the Emma Stone character and the Ryan Gosling character, just you didn't really care if these two got together. You didn't buy in for how it ended. Yeah. So I guess for me, the question is, did you want to see Chiron and Kevin get together?
Yeah.
Can
I answer that question almost before you finish asking it? I'm so sorry that I want to jump in.
Kind of excited about that.
So
one, huh?
This is what I was wrestling with too. No. Like, so the reason I think this film is so masterful is, on the one hand, you could ask the question, are you rooting for Chiron and Kevin to get together by the end of the film? And I think the film is masterful enough that it doesn't answer that. Like, for me, it hadn't even told me if the two of them together would be a good thing. Like, I don't even know for myself, are they going to be good together? Are they meant to be together? Do you know what I mean? I think that the film, on the one hand, it plays with your emotions in a way that It doesn't feel like a foregone conclusion, or you're not yet asking yourself, oh, gee, I hope they get together. You're saying, gee, I wonder if they're going to be able to get together, like, because you don't necessarily know where they are in their lives because the film has skipped around. You don't really know, even if the moments that they had originally were authentic, and you know that the last time Chiron saw Kevin, Kevin was punching him in the face. So it's like what's the next step from that? Yeah,
when he
yeah, and
the
film is really good at building that tension. And so, to be quite honest, I never asked myself, am I rooting for them or not? I'm just watching it unfold and kind of hanging on every moment to see, like, is this going to work? Is it going to work out? Where are these people in their lives? Are they going to be able to get together? Are they going to try? And then you're just going to see no. But yeah, anyway, good question.
Well, there's a grim reality to that ending too, considering Chiron, not known as Black, he is a drug dealer, and just like what happened to Juan.
Well, Kevin knows that though. I mean,
I know, but that's the grim reality. Like, they could be happy. Who knows? They could date for a while. And then, you know, sadly, you know, maybe in the end of the movie,
he passes
away.
But Kevin even brings it up. Like, this ain't you.
Yeah.
That you're not this dealer. And so I think that in a way, let's just say for the sake of argument that they did get together, that he wouldn't put up with Black.
Right.
He wouldn't put up with Black being
right.
a dealer. He would expect him to do something better with his life.
You know what? I could see him, in a way, if they do make it work, I could see Chiron leaving the life because
right.
since he is a drug dealer in Atlanta.
Does he
give himself a fourth name?
Does he go back? Yeah. Like I said, it's got to be Act 4. He doesn't go back to Atlanta. He stays in Miami.
Yeah, and then
he starts his life over again.
I'm not sure what life he'd go for, though.
Well, Ken, go ahead and bring us your impression about what do you want to see these two together?
I think they're too different after these years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That it's not quite the same. And besides, isn't Kevin married?
No. Kevin had a baby mama.
He has a daughter.
They're all together.
Okay.
He has a daughter son. No, he has a son. But they're not together anymore. He mentions it because, again, that opens the door for there to be a relationship.
Yeah.
Or at least that's what we are implied to kind of feel at that particular point. But why do you think that they wouldn't connect together?
Short term, there's a spark there. There's a spark going back to teenage.
Mm-hmm.
I think they've just drifted too far apart in the meantime. I mean, one's a chef and everybody's a street drug.
Well, I think one is a line cook at a restaurant. I don't think he's a chef.
Yeah,
no.
I get
the sense that he might be like a head chef of a very small bistro, because he definitely has enough pull to make a Cuban meal.
Chicken, rice, and beans. Yes.
Well, he does, but it does. They give you the impression that he has some say in the menu, which means that he has some sort of clout, whether he owns the joint or not.
Well, he specifically makes something off the menu, so I don't know.
But he brings it up. It's like, oh, when did you start cooking Cuban?
Yeah. I totally root for them, and I hope it works out. But then, again, something is telling me that if this film were to continue, again,
if we had Moonlight?
Yeah, after Moonlight.
Yeah.
What do they call that? Eclipse? New Moon? I don't know. do we have to? I think that it might just be this is what allows Black to become Chiron again. Like maybe this is just what lets
him. No, he needs
him.
A fourth name. He needs a new name at this particular point because at this point he has transversed all of these. He has
maybe
transformed
himself. Maybe he starts a podcast and becomes, who knows?
Or maybe he becomes an artist.
Yeah.
We get the sense that there's something artistic about him.
He names himself Moonlight.
No.
because his earliest, one of his, no, it wasn't his name. It was,
Blue, I mean, yeah.
Blue, was a nickname given in the Moonlight.
Yeah.
Why not?
And
I mean,
and that was the
Mahershala
unpublished...
Ali recorded music as Prince Ali, so you know we just don't know.
So yeah. Would that make him the artist formerly known as Prince?
The artist formerly known as Prince Ali.
Ali.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, let's talk about these actors right quick because
I love every single one of them. There's no one in this film that phones it in.
Nope. Even the teenager that played Chiron. What was his name? Oh, Ashton Sanders.
Yes.
Yeah, he was really good. He was terrific in it. Single person.
Every performance here was great. I'll say this. When I initially came out of the film, the story itself felt a little kind of melodramatic and a little kind of cliche. But what really set this film apart, and one thing that I've always said about this film, is the acting here across the board is incredible. I mean, every performance felt it just felt important. It felt like it connected with one another. This was an ensemble to the best extent. I would say that this is on par with anything that you would see with the moniker of I completely lost his name.
What?
No,
Barry Jenkins.
Not Barry Jenkins. The West Wing. I'm kicking myself.
Sorkin?
Rob Lowe?
Sorkin, yeah.
Oh.
Sorkin. With an ensemble with the likes of Sorkin.
Yeah. Yeah. And definitely these films that are about coming of age and telling stories over time, inevitably someone's aging makeup never works right or whatever. The kid actor never works out or the middle age actor never works out. Like eventually these films fall apart somewhere. Like you see you see the cracks happen somewhere and this you don't.
Okay. So I guess for me though, let's talk about the individual performances. The performances that really stand out. And I guess we should go ahead and start off with the one who won the Academy Award.
Best Supporting Actor, right?
Oh my God, I'm very happy that he won. Although I will say though, for me though, last year was a tie between Mahershala Ali and Ben Foster for Hell or High Water. Both of those performances, I couldn't pick one over the other. They were that strong. And when I saw that he won the Academy Award, I was extremely happy because every scene that he's in is important.
Yeah.
Every scene. I mean, he's the first person, even though this character is about Chiron, or this movie is about Chiron, he's the first person that we see. He's the character that we're introduced into this film for, and we see why he's important throughout.
Right, and you feel his absence as much as you feel his presence, and that's, I think, important.
Well, one thing I know is about Mahershala Ali as an actor, because, I've seen House of Cards and 4400.
I think everybody here.
And 4400, and what was the other show? Oh, yeah, Luke Cage. And but where I got interested with him as an actor was in The Curious Case of Benjamin Button. He was in it. And there's a scene in the end where the character Benjamin Button is recollecting all the people he met, all the people he loved and appreciated. And Mahershala is there in the scene. And he just does a very subtle move. And it was that big, but it does leave an impact. And that's the one thing I know is his strength as an actor. He's great when it comes to subtle performances. And those nuances is very hard to really capture, but he does it perfectly. I don't know how he does it, but,
Well, that's because he's a character actor. And this is one of the reasons why I love character actors more than I love stars. Because character actors just have this... They have this nuance. They have this sense of understanding their characters. They know that they don't have the same kind of time frame that a main protagonist is. So they use that time to get you to understand their characters. They have to jump in really quick to get you to understand who they are, and they have to leave an impression. And Mahershala Ali is one of those performers that he does that right from the beginning. I mean, the first time I saw him was in the 4400. And I remember that character so strong that every time that I saw him in anything else prior after that, I knew who he was because he left such a strong impression in that film. And everything else that he's done since then has only added to this, so that when he does show up in this film, even though I had never seen anything about this movie, I knew what I was getting with him. And I knew that when he was on fire, this was going to be someone that I could gravitate to. And especially when you get to that swimming scene, which I think, in my opinion, is possibly the most pivotal and the most memorable scene in the film. Not to say that any of the other films aren't, but just on a visual perspective, the image of him holding this little boy in his hands and teaching him how to swim, this very innocent and sweet gesture. And it's played up by the fact of how he's playing this performance, how he's being, he's both strong and yet he's soft. He's capable of being a man, but he's also capable of being a father. And to me, that's the beautiful thing about this performance. And if you think differently, or if you have anything to say about this, I certainly want to hear it.
I think that was the most analyzed scene of 2016.
Yeah. And I think, again, with regards to the cast, again, I think everyone hits it out of the park. I don't think I think Janelle Monáe was one of the surprises of 2016. Oh, between Hidden Figures. Yeah.
I still have to see Hidden Figures.
Yeah, she's a triple threat, man.
God, I mean, I've been a fan of her for her music for quite a while.
Yeah, no, that's what
I mean, just to have seeing
her not in a suit.
Yeah, seeing her on screen and the kind
but
of
she's
presence.
A real triple threat. I mean, she's gorgeous. Yeah, yeah. She knows how to sing. She's a terrific musician. You know, you listen to her albums, and she could act. It's like, fuck.
So, and I think the fact that this is
so sorry
really,
for the guy.
That this is really an example of the little film that could. I think going into the Oscars.
Yeah, it only cost like not even $2 million.
Right. And I think, and as Eric said, like there was no, like you didn't hear about this film until people told you you should go see it. Like
okay,
it was just kind of one of those things that grew on word of mouth and critics talking it up. I mean, they didn't invest money on like getting this commercials on air and stuff like that. Like it really built on its own momentum. And I think, to be honest with you, to go into the Oscars after last year and kind of the whole Oscar so white controversy and saying, okay, what is the answer going to be? Like how is Hollywood going to respond?
Mm-hmm.
How are film goers going to respond? How are film critics and Academy voters and like how is everyone going to respond?
I'm sorry about that, Lobster.
Yeah, no. I just want to say, like, I think you could read that last moment of the Oscars as this kind of moment where if you want to read it as La La Land getting the rug pulled out from under it or whatever, but I feel like the cast of Moonlight and the crew of Moonlight had built kind of this reputation for themselves on the award show circuit. Not only were they stars of a really great movie, but I think they kind of embodied the spirit of the film in a way that as soon as that happened, everyone in La La Land was like, oh, yeah, obviously, like, obviously they deserve to win Best Picture. I mean, here we all are on stage and we're being told a mistake was made. But I mean, my God, of course, Moonlight deserves to win. Yeah, I think that like that's really telling. I mean, this wasn't like a drawn out, protracted moment. It was like, yep, obviously get up here. Like you guys deserve this. And I don't think that you would get that narrative with very many films.
No, but this is one of the things that this is where is going to start like a certain debate or controversy. And I'm not trying to say anything negative, but my thing is this. Okay, when it comes to Mahershala Ali winning for Best Supporting Actor, you could see that happen. Even if there was no such thing of Oscar So White in 2015. Yeah. And the same thing for Adapted Screenplay, you could see winning. But the real question is that if that incident didn't happen, Oscar So White, would have I really won Best Picture?
You mean was this an intentional course correction on the part of Academy voters. Well,
it's like yes and no. You know what I'm talking about?
Really, you know, debatable. What? I think the narrative, if you look at the narrative really early on, it was that it was going to be Birth of a Nation, was going to be that film.
No.
And that, when that fell apart so fast, I mean, one, I think because, I think one, because Birth of a Nation just wasn't that movie in terms of the way
it was not that good.
Yeah. Yeah. In terms of the way it was made. And obviously there was a narrative there with the director that really didn't sit right with a lot of people. So I think what Moonlight was the example of, you know, I mean, it you're right. Maybe it was in the back of people's minds as they're sitting down to vote. Maybe they said maybe this would have been a film that would have been written off because, again, like I said, it was the second lowest grossing Best Picture winner, just ahead of The Hurt Locker, by the way. And it maybe people sat down and said, you know what, I'm going to give this a chance. Like, I'm really going to give this a chance and watch it. And again, maybe there was some intentional voting that was like, you know what, let's give it to Moonlight if you're split between two movies. But maybe this was just people saying, let's really give this film a chance. Yeah. Now, again, I think it had momentum behind it. I think anytime that a film, when you click on the Wikipedia page, the list of accolades received by has its own page on Wikipedia.
Yeah, it does. So does, like, IMDb.
Yeah, you look down the list, and I mean, it's literally, I don't know if it counts up all the words or all the awards that it's won, but it won a fair number. The total number of awards.
It wins by the word.
Yeah, it won 123 awards out of 257 nominations.
Man.
So, I mean, that is something. This was not a film that was overlooked by everyone but the Academy.
Let me just put it this way, because if that wasn't controversial enough, I'll go ahead and I'll say it myself. As much as I enjoyed the film, and I guess I'm kind of putting out my opinion of the film, I still believe that the critics were had overhyped it. I think that this film was extremely overhyped. Am I glad that the film got the attention it did? Absolutely. But I think that the critics completely glossed over the problems that the film had.
Well, yeah. This is my hypothesis. The reason why I feel like sometimes critics do that and do that, not on purpose, but let's say accident. You know, if you are a professional film critic or have access to be a critic, you know, you're going to watch literally maybe 300 movies in 1 year, mm-hmm. or 200 or 150. And you're going to watch a lot of formulaic films, a lot of, you know, garbage. The finally, when you see one really good one,
but that's,
you're going to go cuckoo for it.
Yeah, I mean, let's take it to the Oscar so white thing right quick, because because Moonlight wasn't the only African American.
Yeah, you could give
film.
It to Fences. You could give it to
Fences.
Hidden Figures.
Was terrific.
Hidden Figures.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't have to be. Yeah. I mean, it's clearly not the token in the field of nominated.
And in my opinion, I will say this, Fences should have won. Out of the nominated films, if I were to vote, I would have voted for Fences. And if we ever talk about Fences at some point, we will definitely get into that. But the thing is, though, is that the critics way overhyped this to the point that it did kind of affect how I looked at the film coming up to the Academy Awards, because the thing was, is that every time I read something, they so blatantly ignored the problems, so blatantly didn't acknowledge the issues with the cliches that it went through, the kind of some of the structural elements that just didn't make a whole lot of sense. They completely glossed over that to shine a light on it, and it felt dishonest to the point where I was really to the point where I was like, I didn't really care if Moonlight won or not. And then, of course, I saw La La Land, and then I was begging anything but La La Land.
Bet you were on the edge of your seat.
Yeah, but
Caesar was here with me. Yeah, he saw my response.
Yeah. No, for me,
I guess for me, it, you know, you could make that this was a course correction argument. And I guess the other thing is to say that the film didn't have a traditional campaign behind it. It was just thriving on word of mouth. And I think that when you're a film critic, as Caesar said, and you see something that's good, you tend to speak in hyperbole, just as you tend to speak in hyperbole about films that you don't care for. Mm-hmm. So it's not surprising to me that that there was some overhyping going on. Okay. I think a lot of films get overhyped, and that's why it's harder to predict, I think, sometimes how an Academy is going to vote, because they're judging the films and not necessarily the hype.
No, I understand.
Well, you know what I thought was so strange for me was that in 2016, well, other than being a tough fucking year for everyone, I thought it was a horrible year for feature films. I thought it was one of the worst years ever for feature film. Now, there's going to be people that are debate me, but there's enough for me to say, no, look at these movies, look at this movie. But it was an excellent, I'm talking about magnificent year for documentaries. And and when you look at the outcome of, you know, 2016, yeah, when it comes to feature
films. They had to give it to The Longest One.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah, no. Yeah. No, but if you ever watch it, that shit is excellent.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, my God. That is like a knockout.
All right, I really want to talk about the studio right quick, if you don't mind. Because the thing is that we've already talked about this studio before, just about a month ago, because A24, the studio behind this film. Actually, we talked about several of the films, actually, in the last year. We talked about...
Keep coming back to them.
Yeah, because they did Room, a couple of months ago, which we all liked. They also were responsible for The Lobster, by the way.
Yes.
There you go. They were also responsible for Ex Machina. They were also responsible for The Witch, which we haven't discussed, although I have a strange feeling at some point we're going to be talking about that film sometime.
American Honey?
Yeah, they've done American Honey, which is now available.
How about American Hustle? They did that too, right? I think they did. American Hustle.
I don't think so, but I know that they're also responsible for Wing's favorite film, Spring Breakers.
Hey,
oh yeah.
I mean, they did Room. Did you say Room?
Yes.
Yep. Room.
Said Room right off.
Yeah. Oh shit! I wasn't listening.
He loves Room.
Okay, so what's it going to be in 2017?
Well, actually, they have several.
Free Fire? Could it be Free Fire?
Well, Free Fire already came out and it bombed.
Yeah, okay.
But
I heard The Killing of a Sacred Deer was good.
Well, that's the new one from Yorgos Lanthimos, the director of The Lobster. The one that I'm excited about this year is A Ghost Story with everyone's favorite Academy Award winner. Mr. Casey Affleck and Rooney Mara.
Okay, Rooney.
I saw the trailer. I'm really excited about that one. Okay. The Disaster Artist, which is about and of course the one that the summer movie that I'm most excited about right now is It Comes at Night, which I believe is coming out in just a couple of weeks here. I can't wait.
Before we wrap this up, there's something we need to talk about. There's a white elephant in the room when it comes to Moonlight.
Is it all four hosts? Oh, I'm sorry.
No.
Actually, not all four of us are white.
Okay, all right.
Fair
enough. Sorry.
I don't know if you heard, but you know, a lot of people were feeling that, you know, Barry Jenkins was copying another filmmaker's aesthetic, and the filmmaker happened to be named Wong Kar-wai. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Sure.
Are you familiar with Wong Kar-wai and his films? I don't know if you.
What Wong Kar-wai film did we talk about on here?
We haven't talked about him yet.
Oh, we haven't? Oh.
No. In the Mood for Love is his big one. The one that I thought that Kent would have seen would have been The Grandmaster, which was a retake on the Ip Man.
Yeah.
Wong Kar-wai, he's done a whole bunch of indie films. He's like Barry Jenkins. He's very character-centric. Loves following characters, very subdued, very kind of low-key, but very good films, although I have a hard time staying awake with many of them because they do have that tendency at times, lots of times, many times.
Yeah.
Sorry. Yeah. But
You're saying they have times where they...
Yeah, I mean, I guess for me, it's not surprising. And this is not... I mean, Barry Jenkins hasn't directed a lot of films, right? Like, this is him...
No. This is his third feature film.
Well, his second feature film, but technically he's directed three things. But at that point, it was just a lot of short films and then two feature films.
Yeah.
And then he's done some stuff afterwards.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. Like, I could also say that it feels like a Bronx Tale, or it feels like other films that we've seen before or heard of before. But I think it all comes together with something different.
Well, on YouTube, there's this video called Moonlight in Wong Kar Wai, and it's done by a guy named, I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name right, but Alessio Maranassi. I don't know.
I'll put some links with the podcast to tie it up, because it does definitely show that there is definite inspiration. It's not showing that there's any kind of stealing. He doesn't steal. This is definitely influence, but not homage, but not copyright. But yeah, you can definitely tell, especially when it comes to his lighting. The cinematography here feels a lot like Wong Kar-wai. Lots of use of kind of these neon and not really neon, but kind of like muted, but soft, but strong blue colors.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's informed by its title, the title of the original play as well, which is kind of cool.
Yeah.
Certainly the closing shot of the film.
Right. Well, I know that we're running a little long here. Are there anything else that we want to bring?
Did you guys talk as much your first go around?
Actually, no, we didn't.
Hopefully our recording survives on this one.
Yes, I do too. I have double backup, so this is making it through. It might not be the best audio, but it's coming through this time. I made sure. I've taken precautions.
All right. So to recap, we vote pass, fail, maybe, right?
Yes, but we need to do Geek Sheet right quick.
I forgot about Geek Sheet.
Don't forget Geek Sheet, man.
Oh, there's a lot of Geek Sheet.
So
surprising Geek Sheet.
Mahershala Ali, we mentioned, has been in some cool properties. He first came to my notice on a show called The 4400, which was about a bunch of people who were abducted from the past and then plopped in modern day, but they were all from different time periods. And if I'm remembering correctly, Mahershala Ali played a guy who was like one of the Tuskegee Airmen, I think.
Yes. And he ended up in an interracial relationship.
And I really thought, and this was like USA cable television, like literally, I think it was the USA Network, which I don't.
Well, it was also produced by Francis Ford Coppola. So.
Yeah. And it was, and I really liked him on that show. I thought he was a lot of fun. And then they end up having a child, right? And the child has superpowers or something. Or did they all have superpowers? I forget. With that one, but and then he shows up again in House of Cards as Remy Danton, who's a lobbyist, and then of course I love his turn in Luke Cage as Cottonmouth.
Yeah. All right.
So what else you got for Geek Sheet? Huh?
Oh, honestly, there's tons of stuff. Harris,
Miss Moneypenny is in here.
Yeah.
Yeah, but she was also in the Pirates of the Caribbean films. She was also in 20 Days Later, and of course one of my all time favorites. The Michael Mann version of Miami Vice, where she got to play a badass.
She was also
cop.
Fan cast when we did our plot points movie pitches. I cast her in my time travel movie as directed by what's his name from 28 Days Later, who directed
Danny Boyle.
Yeah, Danny Boyle, as directed by Danny Boyle. She was in it.
Interesting.
And she was also in 28 Days Later.
That's fan casting. I don't think that counts.
And of course, we mentioned Janelle Monáe and
the Arch Android.
What was her first role in IMDb listed?
Well, I know that she has a lot of music involved.
She was one of her earliest parts. She was a musical background, semi feature type. And now Janelle Monáe in a scene in Stargate Universe.
Awesome.
So you got a little bit of a Stargate there.
Yep.
But so I also want to bring up the cinematographer. We've mentioned James Laxton before, but I believe it or not, Kent, you should know his work because he was the cinematographer for a couple of Kevin Smith films Tusk and Yoga Hosers.
Two I have not yet seen.
Oh, really?
I'm very shocked about
that. Sorry about that.
I wanted to see Yoga Hosers more than Tusk.
Tusk, oddly, it didn't happen. It didn't even come out around here. Yoga Hosers, I think, is on Netflix now. You can watch
it.
I think Yoga Hosers is on Amazon, if I'm not correct. Okay. I think Yoga Hosers and Tusk are on Amazon right now.
Sweet.
Okay.
But anyway, so we'll draw it there.
And hopefully a lot of the younger actors in this film we see again. I definitely like...
I definitely like the
Chiron from the middle section. I liked him a lot.
If I'm not correct, one of the...
Ashton Sanders, yeah. Teenager one?
Yeah.
Well, the teenager one. I mean, he was a teenager.
Yes.
Yes. You know what I mean. No, but yeah, he was terrific. And that's
one of
the
Power Rangers? No, I'm just kidding. He's going to get himself cast in something like that, I'm sure.
Well, actually, right now we're in the midst of the whole X-Men New Mutants casting, and they're pulling a lot from the new talent, kid talent. So
yeah, cool.
I have a strange feeling one of these kids are going to make their way as a mutant.
Yeah, sure.
Especially considering what we've seen so far of the casting there. All right, so let's go ahead and let's call because this has already gone a little bit too long. All right, so Kent, Kent, Caesar, Lobster, do you agree with the critics on Moonlight? Do you give it a pass? Do you give it a fail? Or do you give it a maybe? Caesar.
A pass. Yay. Oh, yeah, pass.
Anything else? All right, Lobster.
Yeah, I give it a pass as well. I don't know how much more I can add to what I've already said, except for a film that I knew had won Best Picture and I knew was critically acclaimed, it still surprised me with how good it was, because sometimes I'll watch Oscar-winning films like Argo and be like, yeah, but no. Like, no, it really wasn't that good. And then I'll get... a bunch of people upset and worked up over things like that. So for me, sitting down watching Moonlight, I really enjoyed it, and I thought that it definitely deserved the accolades that it had received. So pass for me. And again, thank you for inviting me back on Art House Legends. Always fun to step into the fray.
All right, that's okay. You can leave the keys at the door. But Kent.
Pass. Mostly just on the strength of the acting alone. I don't think you could look at this movie and go, oh, how did that person get an acting job? They're not so good. Which there are movies we've hailed before that, like, there's one or two people that, like, how did they? But here, no, everybody is... I want to say everybody deserves an Oscar, but, you know, there could be only one. Well, unless you're this year and you misread a card.
There's an honorable mention.
Thanks. Yeah. But, so definitely a pass.
Well, I'll just say that if I were measuring this from the amount of hype that the critics have given it, I would have probably said maybe. But quite honestly, the performances are so incredibly good. And what Barry Jenkins does here is he definitely hones in on these performances. He really makes them the centerpiece of the film. And while there are problems with the structure a bit and some of the cliches that the movie hits on a little bit too hard at times, I'm not going to ding a movie for having that, especially when it does extremely well. So I'm going to pass the film, even though there are some problems with the film. But again, it's just the strength that it has just outdo what the film does not so well. So I definitely think that this is a film that people need to give it a chance if you've never heard of it. Although I do want to bring up that I found it very interesting that I work in a place that is primarily African-American. And whenever I've talked about the film with my coworkers, or I brought up the film, a lot of them either have never heard of it or they show a complete disinterest in it for not the most politically correct of reasons.
Yeah, and that's something that we didn't talk about, which is the sort of place of being gay in African American culture. And I don't like the film, to its credit, doesn't get up on a soapbox about it. But it doesn't definitely have to. Yeah, you definitely sense that there it's not something that's comfortable.
Well, what it is that the film, it definitely is talking about masculinity, and it does kind of look at homosexuality in that element of masculinity and strength. And I think that the film definitely does kind of imply that to be homosexual is to be considered weak, which is something that the African American community is against. They don't the appearance of weakness, which I think is what the film is kind of talking about in that sense. So it does kind of bring that up, but it's done extremely well so that it doesn't hammer it with a hammer. It just simply implies it through subtler means, which I think is a lot more a more skillful touch than just hammering a message where it didn't have to. But if I'm wrong, please let me know. But I take it I'm not.
Yeah, I mean, again, I can't speak to the reception that the film has gotten in circles, because I've honestly, having this have been the first time I watched it, I haven't talked to anyone else about it. So I'd be interested.
The conversations are going to be interesting, though.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do like to talk about movies with people. I should say that one thing that I've done since graduating from Art House Legends is I'm teaching to the students that I work with a special summer class on film studies, and Moonlight would be a film that would fit squarely on my syllabus. So it's something kind of neat to watch while I'm in the middle of talking about these themes and ideas with my students.
You have no idea how jealous I am, just to let you know.
Yeah, you got to find some place that'll just be like, hey, do you want to teach a film studies course? Cool. Make like, it up as you go. Yep.
That's in my name. Seriously.
Yeah.
All right. So any last words?
No.
Moonlight.
Nah. Is that your last word, Ken?
Backups.
I will say that one of the first lessons that Juan taught Little was always sit, like, never sit with your back to the door. When he goes in the restaurant, he does not sit with his back to the door.
That's true. Because he's former CIA.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. He's counting exits.
Yes, you never walk into a room that you don't know how to get out of. Oh, I'm sorry. Is that a movie that you wanted to talk about at some point?
Born Identity or something.
No, Ronin.
Oh, Ronin. Yeah, I do want to talk about Ronin at some point.
That's why I brought it up.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll save that for next time. This is the Movie Dude, Eric.
This is Kent.
This is John the Lobster.
And this is Caesar.
And Fiend.